Okay. Well, let's see how we both deal with this. It's a pleasure to welcome you. I've been looking forward to talking to you ever since we met last year. I attended a day that you did in Melbourne, a day with Dave. And as always, when I relate with your work, with your thinking, I find it incredibly rich and I learn a lot. And I still am very much in the process of learning with a lot of your material. So I'm not here today in a context where I feel I, to be honest with you, have a strong understanding about where you sit and what you think about a great many things. And yet I have a sense of what I'm interested in. I'm also interested in your history of how you've come to be interested and critical of various contexts. You've spoken out against contexts like Game B, metamodernism, these types of things. That's sort of there in a bit of context between us. We've both have an interest in these fields without identifying with them. In your case, obviously, there's critique that you shared, which I find interesting. So that's some context. I'm here with a lot of interest to speak and to see through your perspective and to engage in some dialogue, perhaps about the relationship between humanity and technology in our moment, how you relate to notions like emergence and, of course, complexity in relation to the civilizational project, right? Where we find ourselves and how to orient in relation. I care about what you care about. I'm interested in that. I'm interested in what you're dedicated to. All these kinds of things. And I'm interested in your views on and your experience of praxis and a real history of work engaging in change processes and in managing complexity as you speak about it. And I'm curious about the application of that in a broad cultural context, a context beyond what is often spoken about in the world of business and organization, which might have a slightly narrower focus, might not necessarily be caring about the organization's function with respect to the human and ecologic organism over 10, 20, 100 years, might be more narrowly focused in terms of how do we succeed in a more narrow time frame. And I'm kind of curious about how you relate to the broader time frame as well. So that's kind of what I'm bringing in. And if I was to just ask, you know, one, I'd like to ask what's interesting to you about any of that. But two, just as a way, perhaps if you'd like to introduce yourself, just in terms of what you care about, why you're interested to jump on a podcast at all. What is it that you want to, like, what is it to deal with this, you know, something like that.
I left IBM about 20 odd years ago now to create a company which is now called the Kinevin Co. Before that, in fact, before IBM, I was in IT for probably about 10, 15 years. And before that, I worked in a variety of, well, World Council of Churches type work. That was the first time I came to Australia, back in the 70s. Yeah. So I graduated in physics and philosophy. That combination is important because we now take a natural science approach to things. I got really curious when I hit 50, and 50 is probably a key point for me. Both my parents died within 10 days of each other, and I had to leave IBM. It just got impossible to stay there. And the Singapore government came along, and basically we got a contract to build their risk assessment horizon scanning system, and we started a company based on that. Now, the company's principles are really important, and that would explain it, right? So we use natural science as an enabling constraint, right? Which means that we don't say you can take and to be honest, most people when you talk about natural science still come off a 19th century concept of what science is, right? So it has changed substantially. But we know that you can't study human beings in terms of creating predictive mechanisms. This has always been my objection to things like a lot of sociology. And an awful lot of organizational change is it tries to adopt a causal model. You know, if I can find these levers and pull these levers, it will produce that effect. Now, I knew that didn't work before we even got into the science of it. So my favorite illustration to make the point is if you give radiologists a batch of x-rays, you ask them to look for anomalies. On the final x-ray, you put a picture of a gorilla, which is 48 times the size of a cancer nodule. 83% of radiologists will not see it, even if their eyes physically scan it. Now, that's a scientific fact. We know some of the reasons for it, linked to the fact that we make decisions by micro-hallucinations interacting with sensory input we still don't fully understand, and we make decisions based on first-fit pattern matches, not best-fit pattern matches. Right? Now, once you start to understand that, you know that you can't build tools or methods that assume that people will be rational decision-makers. Right, so that's one fact, and I'll give another couple that illustrate the point on climate change, which concerns me greatly at the moment. So human beings will not make rational decisions. Right? The other thing, human beings will respond to proximate threat, but not distant threat. So it was interesting, during COVID, people accepted sacrifices that they will not accept for climate change. And that's because COVID was an immediate and proximate threat, and people could see that they were being affected. Yeah. And again, that's just the way we've evolved as a species, and you have to learn to live with it. Yeah. And thirdly, we have to feel that a problem is something we can do something about. If it all just gets too difficult, we can't. So, I mean, I was at a conference in Finland lately, and Nora Bates and I did a fireside chat, which we thoroughly enjoyed doing together. Both of us take a similar sort of attitude to this. But we also had the sort of doom and dire prognostication school, like, you know, explain to everybody that the world is coming to an end. All that does, even with intelligent people, is disable them. Yeah, so they feel unable to take action. And the assumption is, if you just give people all the right information and tell them how bad things are, so somehow or other, they will suddenly change their mindset. Yeah, and magically the world will work. Yeah. So, say, Nora and I have heavily criticized the inner development goals, on the basis that what they say is, well, if magically everybody becomes like us 8,000 middle-class people meeting in Stockholm to talk about how the world should be different, well, it would change. Well, yes, it would, but that isn't going to happen anytime tomorrow. Yeah? So there's a heavy degree of pragmatism and realism in what we do. So one of the things we're looking at, and we've already proved this in four countries now, and conversations actually call after this, is going to go into it in more detail in one country. We've been trying to identify micro-narratives at street level. And that originally came from work in DARPA when I was in IBM. It was picked up by Singapore and elsewhere. So we've been making children ethnographers to their own communities. Now that has the big advantage in that children in their communities are part of those communities. It's not somebody from outside coming in to tell them what they should be or study them like animals, yeah, which is what a lot of this stuff does. So people from their own communities can gather stories at scale. We can then actually say, how can we create more stories like these and fewer stories like those, which is a new theory of change. And then we started to build transgenerational pairs, and this is again based on science on brain plasticity, where you put very young people with very old people together with somebody from government who can make their ideas happen. So you put young, idealistic, open with old, cynical network, which is a great combination, by the way. I call it grandparent syndrome, in that grandchildren will tell things to their grandparents they won't tell to their parents and vice versa. And those can start to initiate small changes at a local level. And we've proved that in several cases, rather than some grand government plan to change everything based on a universal program in 2 years' time, which sounds good for the press. Yeah. You're better with 100 small micro-generated attitudes. And what those will do was change what in complexity theory is called the dispositional state of the system, or the substrate in physics. Yeah? And until the dispositional state of people's day-to-day lives supports the sacrifices needed for climate change, no politician will do it. So you can, you know, berate everything. You can have as many international meetings as you want. You can set the targets you want. But as long as people are working on effectively a 3-5 year electoral cycle, yeah, people have got to make micro sacrifices at a local level and see the importance. And once you've got a critical level of that, the dispositional state has changed so that people will accept the wider change which is needed. I've gone on about that a long time, but to me, that's really important. And the same applies in organizational change. And this is a key complexity message. You start with where people are, not where you would like them to be. Yeah, and you don't tell them they've got cognitive biases, because actually, I mean, Klein and others rightly, I think, argue there are no such thing as cognitive biases. They're heuristics which have evolved because at a species level, they save us energy. So let's work with them rather than try and pretend they're not there. Right? And that enlightenment model of the rational decision maker, if only you give them the right information. Oh, and by the way, if they don't pay attention to it, you hit them with it harder and harder and make it worse and worse. That just isn't the way that human beings evolve to make decisions. And we want to achieve genuine change, whether it's in an organization or society, and genuine change comes bottom up. It doesn't come top down.
Yeah, thank you. You know, one question coming to mind, I'm curious if you could explicate a little bit more about what you mean by dispositional state of the system. Maybe I'll ask that first.
Okay. It's also known as a substrate in physics. Yeah. We've developed a mechanism called estuarine mapping, which is one of three techniques we use to explore the dispositional state, right? Affordance comes from biology. So it basically says what is afforded to you by the environment you're in. So you can have a plan to create a cactus farm, but if you live in a paddy field, it ain't going to work, is one way to put it. Yeah. So we look at three things when we look at dispositional state. One is we map the affordance landscape. Yeah. So what is actually possible within that environment? And a lot of this stuff comes from constructor theory and theoretical physics, as well as the biological aspect. So what is possible in the environment? What are called counterfactuals? Things which are counter to the facts, so they can't change. Or maybe they can't change until something else happens first. Yeah. And then we focus on micro actions to effectively change the energy gradients of the system. And to put it simply, you want the energy cost of virtue to be less than the energy cost of sin. And at the moment, generally, it's the other way around. We also look at the narrative patterns. This again comes from the sort of children and other work. And this also links three things. So in Deleuzian epistemology, what is called an assemblage, so that's a bad translation of the French. It's better to think about an ensemble, yeah, or bricolage. So it's a pattern of things which have come together but are changing. And that's a strange attractor in complexity theory, or a trope in narrative theory. And the stories we tell in the societies we live effectively create downwards causation. Deleuze talks about lines of flight, linked to fruit. How do you escape from these patterns? And you can see them with people like Trump. They trigger and sustain those patterns. So one of the ways that you can manage that is to deterritorialize it, because what happens is that pattern of narrative is territorializing the space so that people can't escape it at scale. Yeah, and I remember the first time I came to Australia, Aboriginal activist was killed next to me. We went to the police and we were told it was only an abbot. And that was a dominant narrative in the 70s. Yeah, it was only 10 years since you guys agreed that they would be registered as human beings on the census. So, you know, those are narrative structures which people fall in with because it's the energy cost of falling into is less. So again, if you look at what we're doing with things like, you know, transgenerational pairs, micro-narrative, and this is a key thing from complexity theory, we're changing the granularity so that things can combine and recombine in a different way. If you try and tackle the big problem, it's too strong. Yeah. If you make it a lot of smaller things, then you can start to do something with that. And then the third area, which we're currently working on, which is agency. And we're looking there at distributed decision making, because if people make decisions as individuals and they're difficult decisions, they suffer a loss of stress. Whereas if you look at the history of humanity, you look at medical units or military units, if you make decisions in role combinations, there's no stress. So we're now starting experiments with distributing money into communities based on their ability to assemble role combinations, yeah, and to spend small amounts of money very quickly. And we can use algorithms for that as one of the good uses of technology, so that real investment can follow things which are working rather than people who say they can do something to change something. There's a general adage in the development sector, for example, that the people who are good at applying for grants probably shouldn't be given them. I mean, that's slightly ironic, but that's the way it is. So that's called 3A. So we're looking at affordance, assemblage, agency, and then starting to make changes in those. And this is complexity theory. And then seeing how the landscape changes. And if it changes in a positive way, we move quickly to reinforce it. If it changes in a negative way, we move to disrupt it. So we're managing the substrate. And the final point on this, the point I always make, is if anybody's got teenage children, they already know this. This is how you manage teenage children. You manage the environment in which they're in. You don't try and manage problems directly. You manage them obliquely. So that's what we mean by dispositional state, is you have to prepare the ground before you decide what plants, and you have to understand what the ground is before you can plant in it.
Yeah, right. So coming back to me. Yes.
Now, this does cause a problem for people brought up in a North, and I call it North Atlantic. It's not West or East. Yeah, it's a North Atlantic. It's a Northern European, North American focus on individual and focus on an Enlightenment model of rationality. Yeah, and that is part of the problem. I mean, it made huge scientific progress, huge progress in terms of condition of humanity, medicine, everything else. But the trouble is, it's based on presumptions which we can't support anymore. So you've got to change that dispositional state. And it's quite interesting. I've done work in indigenous communities in Africa and Australia over the years. They actually have profound scientific understanding, but they don't express it in Northern European scientific terms. And so the language is different. So, for example, in Welsh, I'm Welsh, right? We have no possessive pronouns. In Welsh, you can't say, I own a television. You can just say, I am with a television. Now, that linguistic form tells you a lot about what is actually still a tribal society in terms of the way it works. If you're in Finland, all right, they have half the consonants of any other language. So any Finnish statement alliterates. Right? And of course, alliteration creates sort of poetic forms. So again, those societies are really different. Yeah, Finnish, Estonian, Hungary, that's one language group which is unique in the world. So starting to understand that these perspectives is not a sort of new age fluffy bunny idealism. It's actually sort of realistic, scientific, and starting to understand it. I've got indigenous friends, and I think six seasons they talk about in Australia. And they're really worried because they can't smell the change of seasons anymore, which is actually an indication of climate change. And that's not mystical mumbo jumbo. Yeah, that's actually a sensory system that we don't fully understand yet. We're starting to understand, for example, that smell partly determines whether you trust somebody or not. And by the way, the Finns have a lovely phrase for this. I can't remember it, but it means the distance you keep between somebody, so it doesn't matter if they smell badly. I mean, they have lovely phrases like that, right? So again, what you're trying to do is to understand this sort of stuff or enable people to understand themselves and then shift the things in the right direction.
What is the right direction?
Well, that's the other point. I mean, the goal-based issue is a problem, because if you have goals, it will be based on the idealism of the society you're dealing with, right? We say in complexity, you start journeys with a sense of direction and be prepared to change the goals as you travel. It means you may discover better novelty. And the goals, this is fractal engagement, the goals may be, the direction of travel may be different for different communities. Now we then get into ethics, and yeah, the interesting thing here is a lot of us are going back to Aristotle's virtue ethics. Yeah, I'm going to jump around a bit on this at the moment. But what you're trying to do is to say, well, can we get this system to align, not to achieve a common goal, because that's impossible, but can we get more alignment in the system and more alignment with the needs of the planet? Because you can say there is an existential threat, yeah? And we know that, but telling people about it isn't going to make much difference, yeah? I never thought in the 1970s that as I hit 70, as I did a few weeks ago, we'd be talking about a major European war. And the fact, you know, was at a two-day workshop talking about the realism of nuclear threat the other day. We thought we got past that. So there are genuinely needs. And I think one of the things we say from a complexity theory point of view is you can get agreement on what we don't want to be, but you shouldn't try and get agreement on what we do want to be. But it's actually much easier to get consensus on that. And that leaves open different pathways, yeah, in terms of the way things work. You also then get into this issue about how to habituate it. This is where we get into virtue ethics. So if you look, and let's take organizational change, all the way through the last two or three decades, we've had people decide that you really need to run creativity programs if you want people to be innovative. Now, that's bad science. You're assuming emergent properties have causal capability. So if I staff people of resource, I put them under pressure, I give them a different perspective, two things will happen. They will become creative and they will become innovative. So I've got a correlation between the two, but they're both emergent properties. Now, if people practice creativity, you know, after that initial stage, and we see this in the art movement, for example, which is the legitimate side of metamodernism, then after 10 or 15 years of an apprentice, you know, it's habituated. So then it will become innovative. So what you need to do in ethics, and this is what Aristotle argues, though I'm putting a different science perspective on it, is the initial ethical principles have to be taught and practiced when young. But then if you do that right, so you can't, and what Aristotle said is you can't predict all the things which will happen in the future, so you can't create rules or laws. But the virtuous man, of course, he is talking about men at that time, the virtuous man will more likely make the right decisions than the wrong decisions. And habituation is hugely neglected. Yeah, it's not neglected in practice, but it's neglected in theory of change. Yeah, because habits are, again, a form of energy reduction for humans. If we do something habitually, that's there. So, I mean, I reversed type 2 diabetes 10 years ago. Yeah, 10, 11 years ago. And I got the diagnosis when I was in Auschwitz, which is actually quite a good place to get a diagnosis because it puts it into perspective. And it gave me a week to sort things out before I see the medical profession, right? But I already knew about some of this because we've been working in Broken Hill on, if you put Indigenous Australians onto a bush tucker diet, you can reverse type 2. So I knew it was reversible through diet, yeah? And I knew that from work decades ago. So I knew you could do that. So I lost 35 kilograms over 4 months, reversed it and off the list, yeah? And back doing the things I enjoy, like walking and cycling, yeah? But it took about a month for the eating patterns to be habituated and not difficult to follow, yeah? And that's the other point about climate change or about organizational change. Yeah, you have to habituate things into the system. You have to make them easier. And this concept of energy reduction is key. And this is constructive theory as well from Deutsche. Whatever has the lowest energy gradient, that is probably going to happen. So instead of talking about what you would like things to be, you focus on changing the energy gradient. And yes, as a government, you take responsibility for making some decisions. You know, you can't avoid that in the human system. But the negative agreement is very important because it leaves open different pathways.
Yeah, and that brings to mind to me what then quite naturally becomes, you might see it as a different proposals, different poetic efforts at painting a forwards picture, and those can be accepted or rejected. Nevertheless, there's that movement.
Yeah, I mean, and it can work. I mean, the trouble is the people who are really good at projecting forward projections, if you look at history, are normally demagogues and tyrants.
Absolutely.
So maybe that's not the best way to go.
Yeah. Well, but I'm not suggesting it as like the process ends there, more like being in relation to that as a dialectic in the same way we are in conversation, right? Because
I agree with that.
Even when you say
it's micro level and it's distributed.
Understood.
That's the key thing.
Understood. And in the context where you say, okay, through habituation from a young age, the more virtuous person maybe is more likely to make the right decision. There's still this notion of right. And it's still at some level, even appropriate, it's still okay this way, right? This way and not this way. And then we're talking about, well, what is it to relate with difference of proposal, a difference in way? I know, a part of the work you do is in navigating difference in opinion, right? Disagreement, perspectives that aren't necessarily coming together. That was the other part. There's many others too, but that was another part of your work that I found quite interesting, different structures of relating to difference as that difference that comes through in communication. Could you speak to any of that?
Yeah, and remember earlier I was quoting Aristotle. I actually think you can, the most important thing is to make sure people don't do the wrong things. So I think it's much easier to get consensus on what the wrong things are than to get consensus on what the right things are. So I'd make that as a general point. Yeah. I think it's also important that people work things out for themselves increasingly as they get older. So, for example, some of our work, we say, presents narrative and gets people to interpret it. And then we show them how other people have interpreted the same narrative and say why it's different. Yeah. And by the way, again, we can do that algorithmically. We're trying to remove from facilitation from the process. Yeah. So it is why I don't like the sort of dialogic methods, because they heavily rely on a facilitator and they're not naturalistic in the sense of being part of a natural process of dialogue. So, for example, one of the things we're looking at the moment is to find through micro-narratives through school children stories about problems which are common to people on different sides of a political boundary. And then again, algorithmically, we can allocate funding to people who can assemble role-based groups from across that boundary, and we're not explicit about the political difference, to work on the problem together. Because if you work on the problem with somebody who you've been told by social media to demonize, and you can see you agree on the problem, you can have a conversation about your political differences in your own time and context, rather than having to have that facilitated. So again, we're looking for distributed, you know, and they are dialectical processes, right? You don't want these things to be, you're trying to break from dichotomies into dialectics always, right? But you're trying to make that something which is a distributed function of people's day-to-day work, not something which requires workshops facilitation, which is nearly always imposed by somebody from an external culture. So one of the big criticisms, for example, from anthropology about participative action research, which is really well motivated, yeah, is that it privileges people who match the culture of the facilitator. And you can see that in the big, you know, government labs in the projects in Chicago and elsewhere, is you end up privileging the people who match your expectations. That was my point on the development goals. So the solutions to the problems the world faces, and it is a polycrisis, please don't call it a meta-crisis, please don't call it that, are actually ones that we don't fully know yet. We know some things. We know it's too late not to involve in geoengineering, so we need that under some sort of control. We don't want billionaires deciding to send up a rocket and scatter aluminium in the atmosphere, which is a danger, right? So there are things we've probably got to do, and some things are contingent. We should focus engineering effort, for example, on refreezing the poles. That's now an engineering problem, now not a scientific problem. And doing that would give us some more time to sort out the other issues. But the real solutions are going to come bottom up, and we'll recognize them with the benefit of hindsight, but we can't work them out in advance. And that means mass parallel experimentation to find out what those solutions are, not a limited number of workshops or the sort of, I'll call it admonition politics, yeah, which you see.
Yeah, not quite sure. I haven't heard that term before, but otherwise I think I'm tracking you. Yeah. I mean, as an approach, that sounds right to me. I certainly believe in, well, it's interesting. I invite people into a lot of dialogue, right? And you could call those, we call them sessions. I mean, it doesn't really matter. Get together, right? Never call them workshops exactly. And I don't think about myself as a facilitator, although, you know, I've been tempted once or twice to include that somewhere on a LinkedIn bio, because that's what people recognize as the kind of thing that in principle people get paid for. But I, in general, if someone is involved in interaction, then they're part of the process. Hey, they're not sitting, the idea that they're sitting above it entirely and they're not part of that alchemical cauldron, it's never felt to me quite right. Although at the same time, you know, I'd be curious then to ask you about, let's say, in creating affordances for children to play and to learn and to cultivate virtue, there is a disposition from hopefully a place of appropriate authority regarding what a healthy educational context is. And that is, okay, is this where you would use the word management? In a sense, I kind of want to ask you, what is management? And maybe the difference between management and facilitation might be interesting.
So first of all, I don't see any problem with people coming together and having conversations. I do a lot of it. Yeah. It's just it won't scale. So it's part of the thing, but it's not the totality. Right? And we need stuff which works at scale more than we've ever needed it. All right? So that's kind of like one aspect of this. And I think also process of discovery is important. So give my favorite example. When I went up to secondary school at the age of 11, and that was the period where we separated people in the UK. You passed the 11 plus or you didn't pass. We actually had three schools in my town. We had the grammar school, which was if you passed, the secondary modern if you didn't, and the Welsh school if you wanted to be taught in Welsh, you know, which created a three-way rivalry in the town, which was always interesting, right? Interestingly, leadership in the secondary modern, when the whole thing went comprehensive, leaders who had been leaders in the secondary modern were no longer leaders in the combined school. Yeah, so that's one of the interesting things which came out of it. But the point I'm trying to make is, remember at the age of 11, wearing long trousers for the first time, because we had to wear shorts since primary school, walked up to the front of the class and I got given a card. This is on a Friday, and it said, "You support capital punishment." Now, my mother was then leading the Labour Party in North Wales on the campaign to abolish capital punishment, which I've been brought up and I still think is abhorrent, no matter what, all right? It's a sign of lack of civilization. But I had to speak in favour of something at the age of 11 I profoundly disagreed with for 7 minutes without preparation. Now, we did that every week from 11 to 18, and those of us who were good at it were taught rhetoric. That made us generalists. You didn't know what you were going to get hit with, yeah? So you read everything, yeah, just so you had some ideas. It also made you critical, because arguing for something you don't believe in, yeah, in a play environment, makes you far more aware of how other people are using those techniques against you and the subtleties of it. And that is a process, right? And what we keep trying to do in education at the moment is decide what quality we want and teach it, rather than create processes which are more likely to generate that quality. So Australian schools for a long time taught philosophy in primary school. It was a really good initiative. Why you guys abandoned it, I don't know. It was working obliquely. It allowed children to have discussions about ethical issues. And again, that starts to build that dispositional state down time. So I think the point I'm trying to make in is you change people's interactions so that qualities you desire are more likely to emerge, but you may discover qualities you didn't desire, which turn out to be more useful. So you remain open to those possibilities and you reinforce it. But you don't get rid of the responsibility for management. Yeah. Now, the origin of the Italian of the word manage in English is significant here. Yeah. So it comes from a word which I can never pronounce, but it means the ability to ride a horse in dressage. Right? That's the origin of the word manage. It then gets corrupted by the French. You know, many things have been corrupted by the French, not as many as by the English, but many, to mean household management. So effectively, we have manage or menage. Right? Both are necessary in different contexts. The trouble is we've forgotten about the riding horses and we're just focusing on the household budgets. Yeah. So I think, management is something we need to be aware of, but we need to be aware of it's more about, and good leaders do this, by the way, really good leaders don't do much. They really don't do much. It's like a good sports star. They've always got time on the ball. Yeah. Because what they're really doing is stimulating the system. Yeah. And then responding when things happen, which seem to be beneficial, and disrupting when they don't. And that is complexity management. Yeah. And to my mind, that's also leadership. Yeah, and again, that comes back to what I talked about, the work we did in South Wales to generate lots of local initiatives, whereas the civil servants wanted a grand plan where they would decide what the outcome would be. It would cost millions of dollars, it would run over 2 years, it would look good for the press. We've been doing that for centuries. It doesn't make any difference, except in very rare contexts. You're much better changing the energy gradients and then responding to stuff which comes out of it. But you can't pretend you're neutral. Yeah.
Right.
And that's the point. And you also got to recognize democracy is different. So democracy in a tribal society is very different from democracy in a post-enlightenment, you know, society based on individualism. Yeah. In terms of expectations, gifting communities, which are strong in Indigenous Australia. And that's one of the areas I think is really important for economics to look at. The minute you talk about gifts in the States, they assume you mean reciprocation. I'll give you this gift, so you've got to give me equivalent value. That's not what it means in Indigenous communities. Gifting is a ritual to say you're part of a community which then has responsibility for you. And then you don't need money. And we could get into that as well. So it's starting to make these changes, see what other types of models are sustainable. You won't be able to design it up front, but you can find what works and work with it.
Okay, so there's two questions that have sort of been with me that in a sense are tangential. I think they're interesting. I think hopefully we can continue to fold the dialogue together. One thing I'm wondering is how you've observed your own relationship to science and spirituality develop over the course of your life. And in that context, I'm curious about the evolution of science. That's a fair thing to say, in terms of, obviously, you could look at that from a cultural perspective, what people take to be science changes. And then we've certainly learned things that then in principle increase our capacity to do science to a certain degree. Throughout that whole process, though, the human being is in relation. And I suppose an example might be at a certain point in one's development, perhaps in adolescence, one might believe that it's possible to know all things or figure it all out in some more naive sense, and perhaps over time develop a sense of humility, but perhaps through that process come to engage closer to the pulse of what is known and what can be known and these types of things. There's something about that that involves a kind of metabolization and cultivation of character that I think we could use spiritual language to speak about. And so, yeah, I'm curious about what those terms mean for you as a praxis in life.
I think what they've become to mean is problematic, right? So when I was growing up, you know, my father, though he was a veterinary surgeon, was a frustrated carpenter. Right. He'd originally been apprenticed to be a carpenter. His father was a farmer. His father was a really nasty piece of work. All right. Yeah. Got a bad vet bill, went down to the school and said, which of my children is bright enough to be a vet? And dad was an apprentice as a carpenter and sent to Glasgow Veterinary School. Right. So my life would have been different if it wasn't for that. But that meant I got taught to be a carpenter with him in the garage. We made three boats together. I started when I was 5 and carried on till I was 16 or 17. That meant I knew I didn't know everything. Yeah. And craft does that. People forget craft. Right. Yeah. And the sort of apprentice models of learning, that teaches you very early on that you don't know everything. Yeah, and you have to observe things. And yeah, I still remember the day he left me in the garage and allowed me to do something without supervision. It's a treasured memory, right? So I think we've lost some of that apprentice model, yeah, which actually creates the right sort of humility, not the wrong sort of humility, the false humility. Secondly, if you look at the history of religion, and there's people now in evolutionary psychology who are arguing that science, and there's the scientific argument now, is that religion is inevitable. It's part of what we are as a species. Yeah. And interesting, the first ever paper I wrote, which got me into severe trouble with the Vatican, was that Yeah, Marxism, Hinduism, and Catholicism were ontologically identical, so could be combined. Whereas Protestantism and capitalism were ontologically incompatible, so should be rejected. And I still sort of go along with that, if I'm honest, in terms of the way it works. And I worked out, I wrote a blog post on this recently. I would probably have been succumbed to the Pelagian heresy in the Middle Ages, partly because I can't stand Augustine. I mean, the old adage, by the way, is that St. Paul takes the worst of Christ, Augustine takes the worst of St. Paul, and Calvin takes the works of Augustine now. So if you're into theology, you'll get that. If not, you won't. But the Pelagian heresy was to say that there is something other than us, but we've got to take responsibility for the world. Yeah. And you can see that in other traditions. Yeah. I think the trouble is that, and also if you look at the history of science, the Catholic Church was as responsible for the generation of science as it was occasionally for the suppression. Yeah. The suppression of Galileo is not for his scientific achievement, but for actually him using it to attack the church in public. The science was encouraged, if you look at Bellarmine. Yeah, you should carry on with this because it's really interesting. So we tend to get into, and that sort of story of opposition really goes back to Descartes and Cartesian dualism. And Descartes was partly doing that, as Mary Midgley pointed out, to avoid, the danger of being burnt from heresy. Yeah. But if you look before the Reformation, the church provided a balance between nation states. It was another authority in the system. Yeah, just war theory, which I lecture on, inhibited war. Right? It was realistic. It said we are going to go for war, so we have to have rules, and people generally followed this. Not in the current climate, but all the international treaties at the moment are based actually on just war theory from the Middle Ages. Yeah. So we need to understand that religion tends to reflect the society we're in, but generally moves us in a slightly better direction. So, the medieval monasteries were the main source of medicine and employment. Yeah, the medieval church allowed people from a working class background to become bishops and have power. Yeah, it was a form of social mobility. And there's a key point in the history of the West called the Synod of Whitby. So in the Celtic Church, the primary unit was the abbot and the local chief. So it was a distributed system. Whereas in the Roman Church, it was the king and the bishops. And there was a major fight at the Synod of Whitby about the date of Easter. But the real fight was about which model was going to come through. And I think the Celtic Church had a better model. It was more distributed. Yeah. But the point is, religion is part of what we are. If you look at Richard Dawkins and look at his website, he's got testimonies of people who became atheists after he preached. As Mary Midgley pointed out, he's created a new religion called Scientism, right? And people are adopting, Old Testament prophet type garb and beards to try and have that sort of context, all right? This is crazy. We just do it. I think what we need to do is to recognize that religion is part of how we create meaning, right? But we need to stop the privilege. So one of the things I think, which is a major problem in Australia, England, and North America, is what I call faux Buddhism. It's kind of like the assumption, this is the magical, mystical East. I mean, noticeably, it's always emphasized by gurus, which is not what Buddhism is really about, right? So it's that sort of leadership model. You see this with people like Ken Wilber. You can see it with a lot of people, kind of like, this is the new movement and I am the leader of the movement. Yeah. And that I think is inauthentic spirituality, if I'm honest. All right. Karl Rahner, who I studied under briefly, brilliant concept of you have to get around to the Vatican restrictions, talked about the anonymous Christian. And basically said everybody was actually a follower of Christ. They were just authentic to their local tradition, which was a classical bit of Jesuit casuistry. Because it basically said all religions are valid in their context, and we should stop seeing them in that way. So I think religion emerges all the way in all societies to express something. You can't avoid it, yeah, and you shouldn't, but you need to be authentic to your own tradition, and you need to, when religion became doctrine, which is what happened with the Reformation, that's when the bad stuff starts to kick in. Yeah, when it's a permeated part of what we are, that's when it's valuable.
Would you say that if we take globalization and, in a sense, the internet and digital as something with many similar properties to the notion of globalization, it's fair to say this is disruptive, transformative of the contexts in which we live and participate. Certainly an addition. Social interaction takes place in a different medium, these types of things. How do you think that's influenced the...
I think they're different problems. I think globalization, well, I mean, the early forms of globalization were imperial conquest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm Welsh. We're England's oldest colony. We'll probably be their last colony if we ever get independence. All right. And interestingly, they practiced empire on us. So every time the English invaded, they had more Welsh troops fighting for them than English troops because they exploited local differences between Welsh chieftains, which is how they conquered India. Right. So that's globalization in terms of taking people's raw materials. And you can see this happening at the moment. All right. So the Chinese have been very successful in helping people in communities so they have access to their mineral wealth. Yeah, that's their strategy. They don't try and change the ideology. Whereas the American and English empires tried to change the ideology as well. But all of those were extractive. So there's a thing on globalization, which is good and bad. But, you know, it's like the slow food movement and the eat food, which comes within 5 miles of where you live. Yeah, and that seasonal advantage. And that's a shift we know we've got to make. And COVID helped us make it, to be honest. And international supply chains are breaking down. Yeah. But I say there's a real problem on that. I mean, I think Britain is going to lose, I can't remember the percentage, but it's a very high percentage of its crops this year because of flooding and climate change. So sustainability becomes an issue. So there's a balance on that, which we haven't explored properly, that we need to look at. The internet has been an unmitigated disaster in many ways. So a friend of mine in the Canadian Mounties had a good way of saying it. He said it used to be every village had an idiot and it didn't matter because people who knew who the idiots were. But now the idiots have banded together on the internet to legitimize idiocy. So what the internet did is it was based on, again, this sort of individualistic enlightenment myth that magically, if every, and libertarian myth, by the way, which is a big problem, is libertarianism. This sort of belief that if everybody was magically connected and had individual autonomy, the world would become a better place. Well, it didn't, because the connectivity wasn't buffered. And if the connectivity isn't buffered, it becomes perverted. So now people can't escape hate clusters on the internet, right? So that lack of understanding of that, but it was based on an ideological assumption, which also underpins neoliberalism and capitalism, that somehow or other individual choices will always produce the right result. Yeah. Whereas anybody from Africa or Latin America, Southern Europe, the Celtic fringe of the UK just doesn't get that. Yeah. Because you've got obligations, your identity comes from the community of which you're a part and you grew up in. Yes, you can influence it, but that's the primary source of meaning. And I think we've got to get back to that community type identity thing. We should see the high level of individualism, yeah, as effectively a 19th, 20th century concept. But the irony is a lot of the people arguing for this are really individualistic in the way they go about it, right? But yeah, that's irony.
Yeah. Hmm. So in terms of how you, back to the thread of your evolving relation with science over the course of your life, what have you found to be, perhaps you uncovered them over the course of your life or not, but what have you found to be the most important movements in science?
I think one thing physics teaches you, because we only know, you know, with dark matter and dark energy, we can only account for about 4 or 5% of the universe anyway. There's an interesting theory at the moment that information may be a new type of matter, which means it has mass and momentum. That I'm looking at, that really is interesting. But physics kind of like teaches you about the things we don't know more than the things we do know, and we can only discover them indirectly. Biology is going down the same route, yeah? So it's becoming information-centric. It's moving away from taxonomies. Yeah, molecular biology rejects taxonomies, which sort of dominated 19th century science. So I think the most interesting movement in science, which you've seen in physics most of the time, all right, apart from odd little things like string theory, you see it increasingly in biology, you've always seen in chemistry, is basically the concept that the world is messy. I call it messy coherence, right? and it's not neat and tidy and ordered and structured, and that there are multiple, you know, unassumed consequences. Yeah. And, you know, some of the examples like epigenetics, you know, which actually means we now know what actually Darwin said was going to be the case, that Lamarckianism was correct. Darwin in his notebook says culture must inherit it. We just don't know the mechanism. But the neo-Darwin, so we now know the way that culture inherits. And coming back to your spiritual problem, one of the ways I argue with young earth creationists, which I have to from time to time in the States, is to point out they're rejecting God's gift of knowledge. Sorry, that's a training in rhetoric. Yeah, because they are, right? The idea that everything is determined by some almighty being is to reject the act of creation, and actually it's not Christian. Yeah, it's a form of heresy. So I think, and it's come back to your point, it's the right sort of humility. It's the humility that understands what we don't know and understands unintended consequences. And really, complexity theory, which is fundamental to what we do, originates in the three-body problem, which is all about indeterminacy. Yeah, then gets picked up in biology and economics and chemistry, Prigogine, Kaufman, etc. Yeah, and then society like me, myself, Basso and others, which basically says, look, this is all really messy. Yeah, messy coherence was a phrase I created, or if you want to be fancy about it, a coherent heterogeneity. We need to understand what we do and don't know. We need to be curious about the other things, and we need to engage in the world. So, for example, superconductors, I mean, you know, theoretical physics said they weren't possible. Then some, you know, experimental physics started to knock electrons together and discovered they were. Then the theoretical physicists had to change their theory. Now we're almost at superconductors at room temperature, which is a huge progress, right? I mentioned that we know the science of how to refreeze the poles. Yeah. And that comes back to an issue for me, is we don't do enough, which is enough decision making focused on increasing options. We always try and solve problems. What we don't do is change the space to have more options so we can find the solutions. And so we should be doing those small things now to give us more breathing space, literally breathing space, like refreezing the poles. Yeah. And you've got to accept the economic consequences. The destruction in the Brazilian rainforest is appalling. But we did exactly the same in Europe 100 years before. So we can't just go in, but there's got to be some sort of new way of thinking about those sort of things. That's macro level. Yeah. So we'll see. But I must admit, I'm starting to get into Gaia theory these days. And I say this with a wry smile and I'm being ironic. Yeah, we're about to get two or three more plagues, all right, including two bacterial plagues. You can see them coming. And I think Mother Earth has had enough and decided to reduce the population. Yeah, so.
Well, I was going to ask you, I think the response before last, one thing you said was, there is something other than us.
Mm.
What did you mean by that? Is that towards that way?
Yeah, it's towards that way. But I mean, the anthropomorphization of God, which is what Protestantism has done in its popular forms, is just another heresy, right? I also think it's perfectly possible to see religion as an emergent property of us as a species and the planet we developed in. Remember, emergent properties exist independently of their creators. Yeah. And that to me is a realistic scientific understanding of the way that spirituality has arisen within humans. All right. And I don't buy this organized religion v spirituality thing. That's a libertarian atomistic type concept. Yeah. Human beings organize. Yeah. So, for example, in the Catholic Church, and I'm a Catholic, right? And a Catholic by conversion, by the way, not by upbringing. So it was a choice. Yeah. If you actually go, I think one of the mistakes we made in Vatican II, although that shifted us to truth and justice, and we should have stayed there, not gone back to sex. Yeah. But one of the mistakes was to get rid of the Latin Mass. Because the Latin Mass was a universal ritual, and it was about ritual and symbolism, which is really important to human sense making. And then we made it about the priest facing the audience and the word. That's the Protestant tradition, right? And it used to be, and if you went to rural Ireland, and I was there in the 70s a lot, right? Yeah, the women would be in the church, the men would be outside smoking, they'd go in for the critical bit, then come out and carry on smoking, but they were solving the problems of the village outside the church, right? So without that, and you know, when I go and see Mary Boone in Connecticut, all right, I might go to a church where we sing a couple of hymns, but yeah, you know, then there's a talk about Palestine, and then there's some political discussions afterwards. Yeah, that's what religion is about. It's about ritualized bringing together of people, yeah, on a distributed basis. And it also, if you look at it, religion generally teaches by what you shouldn't do, not by what you should do. Or it asks paradoxical questions. Yeah, I mean, the famous one is Christ, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. Yeah. Or if you look behind me, that red cross, that's a Gaping Void cartoon. The statement on that is same cross, different nails. It's one of the best cartoons he's ever drawn. Every time I look at it, I have to think about it. What does it mean, right? And that's what we do. We ask religion asks paradoxical questions. It connects people at a local level. It sort of defines some things that you don't do, right? That's just war theory again. So it changes the substrate by changing the energy gradients. But it's not goal-based. It's not determined-based. It's not this is the right way. Yeah, it becomes that when it becomes a matter of doctrine. And I say, I think that was a big mistake.
Mm. Well, I'm not going to be able to spend too long if what I'm about to say becomes historical scholarly disagreement. And it's only really a minor point. It would seem to me that there's been instances in, for instance, the formation of Christianity. Scholars have spoken about the various, what were referred to as pagan rituals, many of which people argue were adapted in various ways. That's not the point I'm making, but there was wide-scale suppression and destruction of various traditions around the Mediterranean associated with use of sacrament. People argue about altered state type experiences, various things. Would it be fair to say that the impulse towards doctrine has been present with us for a longer period of time, and you're identifying a particularly important historical manifestation, or are you saying that?
No, I'm saying these things are evolutionary. So, yeah, yes. I mean, virtually everything you can see in the Catholic Church was actually adopted from a pagan society and assimilated. Yeah. So the seasons, the celebrations, actually linked in with Celtic spirituality, for example, and we can see that. I don't see anything wrong in that. That says the thing is evolving.
Totally. Yeah?
There's one of the great what-ifs in history is the Jesuit astronomers had got the Chinese emperor to agree to do a Constantine. They'd fused Confucianism with Catholicism. Now, if that had happened, the world would be a completely different place, but the Dominicans found out and the Jesuits were suppressed. So that concept of bringing things together and taking the best of things and recognizing reality, that's been part of the evolution of religion. And I see nothing wrong in that, right? I mean,
not it's also critical.
It's kind of like the way it's happened, all right? And sometimes it's gone in the wrong direction. So a friend of mine, Melinda Scott, who's a vet, who writes novels, all right? Really worth buying a novel. She got this wonderful series on Boudicca, who was Celtic, yeah. And then from that, she develops into Rome. And the Rome novels are brilliant because St. Paul becomes Paulus, who's kind of like an evil Roman infiltrator trying to destroy Christianity to make it an institution and destroy its early ideas. And I'm very sympathetic to that, if I'm honest, right? I never liked St. Paul. So I think some of the ways also we retell those stories change it. And we need to retell the stories in such a way that we can see this as moving us forwards, rather than creating this total dichotomy, which you see in the States, in that you either have to be an extreme Bible Belt fundamentalist or you have to be a hyper-rational scientist. And that dichotomy is doing us no good whatsoever. And trying to replace it with new religions or faux Buddhism makes it even worse.
So
you can't design a religion. Religions evolve. You can't design it.
Yeah, right. Okay, how do you relate to the interplay between evolution and the perennial?
Can you explain what you mean by the perennial?
It seems to me that not only do some things reoccur, but let's say the nature of finitude itself, we could say tragedy, suffering, what might be considered, not in particularization, but in a general term, virtues in relation to, let's say, existential necessity, you might put that in the category of at least something, well, we could say the perennial, not to say that how it particularizes.
Okay. I may or may not have understood it, but I mean, we did some work, for example, on ivory poaching in South Africa. Yeah. Now, if I was living with children in one of those villages, I would work with the ivory poachers, even though I know it's wrong. Because it's the only way I can get anything to feed my children, otherwise they're going to die. Yeah. I mean, we need to be careful on this because we get into the sort of ethics of hypotheses and nonsense like the trolley problem, right? But you've got to recognize that reality exists for people and certain conditions constantly recur. Yeah. So what's actually interesting, if you look at the anthropology, is people who are similar are more likely to fight than people who are very dissimilar. Yeah. We like to create differences as a species, right? And in evolutionary terms, you can see the value of that because it creates a gradient. Yeah. So attempts to harmonize people are going to make things worse, not better. That's what we call about coherent heterogeneity. So the way I normally explain that is kind of like, you know, this Saturday I'll go to the last home match of Cardiff this season. Yeah, it's been a truly appalling season because we've actually got 8 losing bonus points. So we could be top of the league with just small changes and everything. The trouble is we're a very civilized team. You know, we play by the rules. We don't bribe the referee. We follow the rules, the crowd, the non-partisan. We're the good guys. Yeah. And the only team we've lost to twice, you know, significantly are Scarlets, you know, in Netley. And we call them Turks because they hijacked a Turkish ship once and killed all the people. So we're not going to let them forget it. Right. And they definitely bribed the referee. It's the only explanation of that red card we got in the match recently. And they can't be trusted. But when the English arrive, we're all Welsh. No? Now, this is also what Bateson talks about, the differences that make a difference. You have to create a system in which people can be different in some contexts, but the same in other contexts. And that's really important. Yeah. And context shifts everything, yeah, in terms of the way it works. And I discovered this first time when I went to work for the US government. I mean, I didn't know who I was meeting. I had a really good relationship with this guy. We were talking about Patrick O'Brien's seafaring novels because they were in his bookshelf. So we had, if you haven't read them, they're brilliant. They take British and naval logbooks. So everything in the novels actually happened. Yeah, the detail is incredible. So we're doing this. He's obviously Navy. And then I look around and see a picture of him with Ronald Reagan and realize I'm talking with Admiral John Poindexter. As a good Welsh socialist, I'm not meant to like him. But by this time, it's too late because I now like him because we got this one thing in common. Which means I listened to it, which I wouldn't have normally done, right? That taught me a huge amount. It was quite a shock to the system, if I'm honest, yeah? And I think that's partly what we're trying to do with it, find something which is in common.
Right.
And then let people work on that rather than try and force them to discuss their differences.
Right. For me, the energy and the care and the lived quality that is the recognition, that is the recognizing of deep commonality, something like that seems to be sacred.
I wouldn't put it like that. I think it's of contextual commonality, not deep commonality.
Okay, so that, good. Okay, so.
And that's a really important difference.
I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. I feel like this is something that might be interesting to go back and forth on a little bit. Now, in a sense, you use the word.
And by the way, the biology would partly support me on that. We know that epigenetics changes things over 2 or 3 generations. Right. So Eva Jablonka's work actually goes to the point of arguing the level of symbolism in your speech affects the intelligence of your grandchildren. So we know that, yeah, and we're not like orcas. They now know there are three separate species of orcas, right? So we do have a common ancestry. But we need to accept that there probably isn't something universal about humanity. There are common characteristics. But we're also social creatures, so our social environment and our language, which is different, is probably more important than the physical state.
Well, I think that's very interesting. What do we have in common that is meaningful with the animal world?
Okay. I mean, I won't eat octopi anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's enough evidence they have symbolic intelligence. And the same is true of the higher apes, not chimps, but higher apes. Yeah. So I think there is something there, right? We have senses in common with all mammals. Yeah. Yeah. But that doesn't necessarily, but we also evolved as predators, right? Sorry.
Of course.
I was in a butcher's buying some sausage, on the weekend in Crickhowell, and also some blood pudding, and myself and the butcher were swapping memories. So when I was a kid, one of my jobs was to look after the pig in the back garden. And then every year the pig sticker would come around. So my job was, when it was strung up by its feet, was to keep it calm and to catch all the blood that came out of its throat when the pig sticker stuck it. And if I missed a drop of blood, my grandmother would kill me. Now that was actually part of the rhythm of society. Yeah, it was immediate, it was proximate, you knew what you were doing, yeah? And I think recognizing we're omnivores, yeah, people can make their own choices is one thing. It's when it gets exploitative or it gets non-personal, yeah? I mean, I grew up on a farm, I grew up going into slaughterhouses. I'm not naive about this, and I think there are conditions which are wrong. You shouldn't treat animals in some ways, right? Like battery farms and such like. And we can change that practice, but we also need to recognize that we're one species in a body of species, and we're linked in with the planet. I mean, I've been talking about this with Tyson and others in Australia. We need a peace and reconciliation process with the planet. Yeah, as much as we do with each other, right? So, but I don't from that get into panpsychism, which is complete and utter nonsense. Yeah.
Yep. I'm not trying to take us in that direction. It might sound like it. I'm not. Maybe I am, but give me a chance. Because
okay.
that's not the intention. So in that opening up to the notion of reconciliation with the planet, it's interesting. Every time I go to try and express what's within me, I'm actually instead opting for asking you a question. And maybe that's the most helpful way to sort of bring things into context in this case. But what would that mean to you then, reconciliation with the planet?
I think it's about balance. So it's buying food in season. And some of that actually, by the way, makes you healthier. I mean, if you actually have untreated milk, then you don't get lactose intolerance. It's the treatment which triggers the lactose intolerance in the main, all right? And you're losing enzymes. And I grew up taking milk direct from the milk tank. But at the same time, one of the things we did in Britain, which was a lot of sense, all right, is we eliminated brucellosis and tuberculosis. We started in Cornwall, we moved up to Scotland, and we killed every animal with those diseases. And we still do. So that allows us to have a more balanced relationship if we chose to do it. So I said, this isn't about being soft, yeah? It's about balance. It's buying food in season. It's recognizing natural products. It's possibly living commune. I mean, my sister lives in, and I lived in a commune for a bit. I would love to go back to doing that. So it's eating in common, sharing resources in common. It's not the atomistic single family with all the food waste that goes with it, all right?
Right.
It's recognizing that, you know, I am part of a campaign to bring wolves back in Scotland because wolves are the apex predator. Deer are out of hand, all sorts of unintended consequences come about. Beaver have been introduced and producing a huge effect on flooding. So we use the rewilding concept a lot, not just in terms of nature, but in terms of human processes. We need to get some balance back. And you don't get balance if you take an extreme position on what's allowed or not allowed.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I like that.
Well, if you go into Celtic ritual, I mean, there's a lot on this. is having a conversation, you know, is ritualizing killing something for food is actually part of most indigenous communities. It's a recognition, right? Yeah, and that's, and it's not that, you know, if you, I've got two cats, all right? I mean, I got very adept at catching the live voles they bring into the house at 3 o'clock in the morning to chase them around before they kill them. I can normally catch them and release them, right? But, you know, that's part of the natural cycle of life, yeah?
Why care about balance?
Well, I think the other thing about humans, all right, is we don't... The problem with humans is we do things which aren't proximate to immediate need. Now, on the good side, that means that we will sacrifice. You don't see sacrifice in animals outside a kinship group. You do in humans. Yeah? The downside is we slaughter people for thinking differently from ourselves, right? So most things are plus and positive in that respect. Again, that comes back to what we talked about. There has to be some sort of consensus on what we don't do. And that's one of the roles of religion historically. It limits those. And if you look at just war theory, I'll come back to that. It's always kind of like one step morally ahead of where society is, but it's never more than one step ahead. And that's kind of like the evolutionary process.
Wouldn't one step look different depending on how far you zoomed in or out contextually?
Yes, it would. And that's important to understand. Right. So that's fractality. But systems, systems are self-similar. That's what fractal means. So if we're in, let's get practical about this. If we're doing a micro change, we'll gather, say, narrative. Yeah, this is the substrate. We'll then present a village with their narrative and say, how would you create more stories like this, fewer stories like that? But then we'll present the government with a narrative for all of the villages and say, how would you create more stories like this, fewer stories like that? So we present, it's a complexity principle. You never aggregate an aggregate. Okay? So you're always presenting the data at the level of people's competence to act. So actually everybody is going in a slightly different direction. But the overall system is starting to align. And that's the principle of alignment by micro nudging. Yeah, but not about trying to align it by deciding where it should be. Right. Yeah, because then you can detect the patterns and you can change what you're doing. And so an example, sure, if you wanted, is antelope. So there's a really fun exercise you can run in a group. All right. So you tell everybody to identify their worst friend and their best enemy. Before you do that, you tell them not to look at anybody or say anybody and say they can do it at random. But they always do pick their best friend. Yeah. And then you tell them to organize themselves so that their best friend is between them and the enemy and the group dissipates. If I change the rule to say protect your friend from the enemy, the group comes together in a cluster instantly. Right? Now, the way antelope keep together is each antelope identifies another antelope and places themselves between that antelope and the predator. And that means the herd can keep together, but it can go to very different places. That's alignment, not goals. Yeah. So how do you align systems is more important than goals.
So in this whole conversation, though, there is a kind of a normativity, or at least a valuation that's like taken for granted.
Well, no, because you have to discuss it and you have to see what's viable in different communities at different times, right?
In its particularization.
No, but what generally, and this is actually how religion works, is your evaluation uses abstraction, which actually carries sufficient ambiguity, you can adjust. Right? So abstraction is linked with abductive thinking in humans. Human beings, art evolves in very advanced ways in humans and not in other species, right? And we think one of the reasons is it breaks you from physical reality, so you see novel connections between things. Yeah. So abstraction is one of the ways, and when we're actually interpreting people's stories, we put them into very abstract metadata structures, which are very high level, and often these days are semiotic or picture-based. Yeah, so the direction is coming through abstractions, which gives you adjustability. But you're not ever going to get rid of the responsibility to make judgments about what we should do. It's how you make those judgments which is important. It also, if you try and make everything neutral, then again, you're coming back to this assumption there must be something underpinning, which is questionable. I would argue most ethics evolves in humans. Yeah, it's evolutionary. It's emergent properties.
Yeah. Okay, so I get you, and it's, well, maybe I get you, you know. Maybe I'm terribly confused. Maybe I get you. Maybe there's a way to go at it like this. So I know you talk with Nora fairly regularly, and I've spoken to Nora a number of times. One of the, I think it's fair to say, core parts of her world and terminology and teachings relates to transcontextuality. What does it mean to participate transcontextually to you?
That's what we're trying to do with the children program. We're trying to get the system to be transcontextual to see what will emerge. So from my point of view, the work we do with SenseMaker is effectively warm data, but warm data at scale without facilitation. Yeah. So right. Nora and I agreed on the nature of the data. What we're not agreed on is the nature by which you capture it and promulgate it.
So again,
That put it this way, a transcontextual negative is easier than a transcontextual positive and is less likely to pervert the system. So most religions have a thou shalt not kill in them of some type or other, but with qualifications. Yeah, we could do with a transcontextual is thou shalt not destroy your environment. Yeah, that's kind of like what I'm interested in is how the hell do we generate that? Because we won't do it by telling people we need it. We'll do it by them seeing it in their local context and that changing the space. Yeah. Does that make more sense? To be transcontextual, it has to emerge with critical mass from hyperlocal interactions. And that concept of hyperlocality is key.
So obviously I said, what does it mean to participate in transcontextuality? You took that to the systemic level.
Yeah.
There's something that, you know, and remember we had this aspect of the conversation where you pump the brakes on panpsychism, and I'm not here to put that forward, but I am interested in the phenomenology of, this is what we're currently on. This is called Voicecraft, this project. You mentioned the importance of craft in relation to humility, you mentioned it in relation to that. And it seems to me that we can speak, we can communicate, we can listen, we can engage in conversation, in seeking understanding in a manner that cultivates a strength of capacity to be aware of where we can speak from more or less strength, more or less appropriate touch with context in relationship.
But I think, first of all, you've got to recognize different cultures have different ways of doing this.
Yeah? Yes.
So in the culture I grew up in, the debating was actually part of the culture. Welsh families will tell you this. We have to explain to people coming from outside, if we argue with you, we like you. If we're polite to you, we don't, right? So the way in which you do this can change by different cultures, right?
Agreed. And I'm not trying to impose. What I was saying is like, was just one point of what's going to be a multi-part expression. So I'm with you. I agree with you. But I'm only saying that just so that we don't go too far off the road, because I, for instance, relate to your mode of discourse as profoundly interesting. And I believe and feel your interest and care for the process of understanding, right? That for me is not in question. I am a little interested in the limits of the praxis of learning to communicate only by virtue of let's take positions we don't necessarily agree with. I think that's helpful, but I think there's also a cultivation of what is actually truthful for me to express here. Again, that's like not from perspective of rhetoric, right? And so but it's not either or. It doesn't have to be either or.
No, it doesn't have to be either or, but I also think you Human beings change primarily through interaction, not by conversation. The conversation then reflects it. If you want to change people, you change the way they interact with each other.
Well, I feel like I'm incorporating the notion of interaction in. That's why I've been trying to use the word communication, and some people prefer. I just mean what it is for us to interact, and we can get up and do a dance, Dave. Do you know what I mean? We can incorporate all lots of elements. I'm not trying to narrowly define
interpretive dance. There are internet memes about that.
I'm not trying to narrowly define or control what it means to communicate or interact. Not trying to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not disagreeing with that. All right. So I've been involved in discussions which are political or theological, which are not debates and are designed not to be debates. All right. So there are different linguistic forms you use in different contexts. All right.
Right.
And you need to be able to adapt those very quickly. All right. The danger is we don't understand cultures which are different from ours, but we can actually sit down and plant some crops together. And then the conversations will emerge, right? So that concept of doing small things together and conversation linked to activity to me is key on the sort of things we're both talking about. And my opposition to some extent is the idea that inner reflection will change the world, but I don't think it will. I think, you know, there's space for some people to do that. It's the contemplative orders in the Catholic tradition, but it's a minority activity. It's not a majority activity.
That may well be the case. I'm not necessarily arguing for the isolation again of what I'm of that mode. It's more like, yeah, but one way I could turn this then to an area of, let's say, practical tension and challenge just in moving and building and living in the present day for me and others, right? Time and space is hard to come by without resources. There's a term I came across from a man named Carl Hayden Smith. I've never read him precisely like define it. I'm sure he has defined it somewhere. So I've kind of just taken on the term and I'm going to define it. So maybe this is not what he means, but the term is contextology. And you don't like that.
I don't like neologism. Ologies are always a problem, right?
Ah, interesting. I'd love to go down that rabbit hole. Again, this is an interesting one, because I'm kind of my most interested to stay with the emergent meaning of what we can share in understanding together. And then there's the combat around whether or not this word, these terminologies are appropriate. And there may be very important scholarly reasons that do matter for the disagreement, but again, might not necessarily be constitutive of the kind of mode of interaction in the time we have available to share in the seeing. You see the point?
I do, but you know, to quote Heidegger, man thinks he's the master of language, but language is the master of man.
Hey, well, we have a podcast. If you and you know, sadly, this lady passed away a few weeks ago, but she was a remarkable being. Her name was Laurel Erica. We have a podcast with her, which we recorded as a network a few years ago, and it was titled "The Sonic Mysteries of the English Language." And this woman believed very much, and maybe she was right. In fact, that she was sent here by the spirit of the earth to be a language fairy, to point out all the various ways that, in fact, the meaning that we encounter in the world is, in many regards, as you say, shaped through us, shaped Absolutely. In us through language, right?
And I don't agree with her origin story, but I agree with the mission.
Well, and so if anybody's interested in that, and it's truly remarkable the ways that the constructions of our language.
Part of the point, English is fascinating. There's a saying in Wales that English is too good for the English. They don't deserve it. Right? And most of their poets actually come from Wales, Scotland, or Ireland. And Shakespeare had a Welsh grandmother and brought 750 Welsh words into English. So we're claiming him as well. Right?
Okay.
But the thing about English, because it's absorbed so many languages, there are so many different ways of saying the same thing. Right. And so you can play games with antonyms and synonyms in English that you can't, for example, in Swedish. And that's my point about, you know, Finnish language is alliterative. So it tends to be poetic if you hear it. Yeah. And Welsh language, if you don't know it, the first letter of every noun changes according to the word that comes before it. So it's evolved so you can effectively sing a sentence as a word, which is why it's almost impossible to follow a first language Welsh speaker, because they're going so fast. Yeah. So, yeah, and that goes back to the Heidegger quote. We need to recognize the power of language. And say the commonality isn't by Rosetta stones, it's by action.
Wow, by the craft and the orientation we bring to the craft, like the care,
Craft
the
again.
care.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
So we're agreed on that. I'm not sure we're agreed on the implications, but we're agreed on that one. Yeah.
well, if it feels valuable to stay in the process of understanding where we may or may not be in agreement, then in some sense we're in profound agreement here together.
That's what it's all about.
Okay. So the notion of telos, what does that mean to you?
Okay, so this is an interesting academic discussion. I think actually human beings have partly worked out how to manage teleological cause. If we go back to Aristotle. Yeah, in the, but how we do that, I don't think it's entirely clear. And I do think it's more defined by negative than positive.
Right, which is a key thread of the contention you've been making throughout this whole conversation. Interestingly, when I was studying international relations, I always found they refer to negative rights and positive rights. Would it be fair to say that negative rights would be in alignment? And I always felt that to be very much the case. I get that. And it's why,
And
though,
it's
I'm so
also interesting.
interested, in fact, in.
So look at the difference between the Versailles agreement and the Congress of Vienna. Congress of Vienna produced 100 years of peace because
Wow.
everybody was dissatisfied. Versailles created a major war within another 20 years. No, because actually one side was dissatisfied and the other sides were overcome. I mean, Lloyd George arguing against that. You know? The one Welsh Prime Minister we've had in the UK. And I think this sort of thing is important, all right? You know, victory or loss, right or wrong. And what I find great irony is the people who argue most for humility are the least humble people I know, because they want everybody to be like them. Right? So you will be attacked for this. Oh, well, you're being argumentative. That's wrong. Well, hang on a minute. There's some contradiction going on here. Yeah, is what you're saying is you have a preferred mode of dialogue, you want to exclude everybody else's. Well, actually, that's what, yeah, there's a contradiction. Sorry, philosophy is terrible for this. It
Fine,
teaches
mate.
you to be consistent, and being consistent is quite scary in the modern world, all right?
No, I think that's very interesting. On that point about the Treaty of Versailles, I was in fact listening to a lecture by Gregory Bateson, which I messaged
Yeah.
Nora about. He's got a brilliant lecture on that.
Oh, has he? I didn't know that. I'll look that one up.
Yeah, he speaks about
But Versailles was a disaster from beginning to end. Yeah.
right. He makes a similar point to the one you're making. Obviously, you know, there's quite a few things he says, but it's an interesting lecture. Okay. You got much time for the mystical, Dave?
Yeah.
Okay.
And part of what we are as humans.
Yeah, beautiful.
And actually, it's also linked with ritual. But I
Right.
mean, yeah, mysticism can happen walking in the mountains on your own.
Right.
I mean, you know, walking down a mountain at sunset can be magical in the sense of, because it's a type of abstraction again. But equally, I mean, I used to go on a retreat every year to Ampleforth, yeah, and just take part in the offices, that sort of rhythm, yeah.
Right.
That's the point of it. But now that's probably an emergent property of human interaction over time. I'm cool with that. Yeah, no problem. There was
Well, it's how long
brilliant
is the
BBC.
time? How
There was
wide a time are we talking about?
a really scary BBC horror thing called The Stone Tape. And it argues that silicon can record human experience, and that explains ghosts. It terrified me when I was a kid. because it was a scientific explanation, i.e. horror imprinted on the stones faster and would be replayed if it was stimulated. And that was interesting because it made that point about the landscape and the involvement and that sort of thing. So we can create things, yeah. And I blogged about this recently, actually. I thought I'd better be honest to it. I mean, my daughter and I were convinced for years there was something in the back garden. We could feel it when we came back, and it wasn't nice. And then she got one of her friends to exercise it, and it hasn't been there since. Now, I can't explain that, but I can talk about the way human beings invest meaning in things.
Right.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and one of the things that science does teach you is we don't understand all the senses we take account of yet.
Right.
We really haven't understood it fully. Yeah.
Right.
And so some people may be sensitive to memories, and, you know, memories can be held in various substrates.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, where I live is Neolithic England. You know, we've got Avebury, we've got, you know, Silbury Hill, we've got, you know, everywhere around here has had people treading it. And this is the mystical centre of the UK. This was a religious centre, you know, for 4,000-6,000 years. And that has some influence on a landscape, and it has influence on human interactions with it. So I think you can say that without getting into sort of New Age fluffy bunnydom, which is a place to be avoided. Yeah.
Let's put all the fluffy bunnies to the side, eh?
We actually have Cognitive Edge t-shirts, which have NAFBS on them, which is a reference to Buffy the Vampire Slayer, New Age fluffy bunner slayer, right? So,
So it's the quest for me that there's such a question in the meaning and constitution of memory. For me, there is a, there are many questions about, well, maybe I'll ask you. It seems to me like, I mean, it's the most basic thing to say in the world from an evolutionary perspective, that we are constituted by other than the human, the pre-human, right? Through the stretch of phylogeny, tremendous amount of interaction, tremendous traversal of context. What can we say about the nature of the continuity that we here share in the modern day with that? These are questions I've been asking for a long time.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting. But I mean, we know several things about complex adaptive systems, all right? One is the emergent properties arise from interactions and aren't constituted in the parts, yeah? Which is actually one of the reasons why you reject panpsychism. You do not need the parts to be conscious for the whole, for consciousness to be emergent property. It's not necessary, right? We also know that systems are path dependent. And we also know that various aspects of our body have memory, yeah? We don't fully understand that. We don't. I was chatting with some anthropologists the other day, because one of the curious things that we know is that when hordes gathered in Asia, they actually assembled faster than the fastest horse could gallop. So there's some form of communication going on there we don't understand. Now, I don't have to get into magical stuff on this. So one of the things I suggested, which they're looking at, so I'm quite proud of this, I don't often get a suggestion taken up. I said, well, most of the shaman were blinded at birth, which would hypersensitize them to smell. And they were voluntary blinded. And we know that pheromones spread very quickly, and pheromones actually determine trust decisions. So maybe there's something about pheromones which actually acted as an organizing trigger mechanism, right? Now, again, that's why I'm fascinated by modern science, because you can ask some of these questions which were originally the realm of, you know, the wrong sort of spirituality, and you're not rejecting either. You're basically saying, hang on a minute, there has to be some reason why people voluntarily had their eyes put out. Yeah, because it has no utility in that society. So there has to be some reason for it. Yeah. Again, it's worth reading Manda Scott's novels about Boudicca. They're really interesting because they explore that type of spirituality and what it means. Mm, and I say she is a veterinary surgeon, so she's got a scientific background as well.
I was always fascinated by Boudicca as an English schoolboy.
Yeah, well,
So,
she was Welsh, remember?
okay.
I mean, remember, Wales, Cornwall, and Brittany are the Romano Celts. We have Latin root words in our language.
Okay. My cousins are Welsh. Okay, we can be friends. Gareth Bale was one of my favorite football players. Okay, so in that example of pheromones, you use the word trust. Now, it's more in the nature, the capacity for the quality that is discernment as such of signal. I'm thinking about that as something which has relevance for understanding in terms of how it shows up transcontextually.
It does, and it's also context specific. So if I see somebody arrive in the mountain rescue, I'm going to trust them. I'm going to do what I'm told.
Yes,
Right?
always
And that's
context specific.
ritualized by the context. All right. We think individual decisions on trust seem to be very odor based more than look based. Yeah. And that may be familiar spells, all right, in terms of the way things work. So there's more to communication than we understand. Trust, the way I'm defining it, is the ability to go with something without validation, which human beings like to do because it saves us energy. So it's not some mystical quality and it's not some ethical quality, it's actually an efficiency quality. You know, kids need to trust their parents. We need to trust policemen, which we don't anymore, yeah.
Well, but if efficiency as a heuristic is
Well, and
critical to
energy minimization, all of evolution focuses on reducing energy cost.
if this is necessary for life being as such to exist in cosmos, then is that not, are we not, is this not just speaking about the very depths of mystical connectivity, just with different language?
It's just saying it is, all right? I mean, nobody's denied, I agree with you, mysticism is part of what we are as a species. Now, whether if evolution took a different pathway it would have been, we will never know, but it is. I mean, actually, I disagree to some extent with Hume, as a lot of complexity people do. Is can be an ought.
Yes, that would be an interesting conversation to have. I think I share with you enough understanding to agree, and that's sort of in line with what I'm suggesting, that the but what I'm wanting to point to is that it seems to me that we can cultivate a capacity for discernment. We can know
Yeah.
in ourselves what it is. I mean, in part, know thyself, like
It's
philosophy
quite
as
difficult
such.
after you reach your 20s,
How much of
biologically.
that is contextual? Okay, well.
No, actually, that is partly biological. So you don't see racism in kids till they hit puberty. Then everything starts to lock down after that because you've got to adopt the prejudices of your tribe. Opens up again at the sort of grandparent stage. So it's why we try and work with people around puberty because that has the most capacity for change. And also, for example, kids can have more influence on adults than other adults. Yeah, particularly if they're related. So I think you need to get realistic about this in terms of, and again, everything we're talking about is what do you do at scale?
Well, that's
What
everything
not
you're
works?
talking about. That's
Yeah,
not
that's what I'm talking
necessarily everything. I haven't
about. And
given that.
that's my disagreement with Nora. I think, yeah, my view is we've got to do warm data at scale, and we will not do warm data at scale by training limited numbers of people in workshops. And we have disagreements about that. We agree on things like abduction, yeah.
No, I hear you, and I think it's a, like, I'm very interested in that conversation. I'm not here putting myself on one side or another of it. You know, what does that make me interested in facilitating a conversation in relation?
That's all good news. Yeah.
Right. Well, Well, it seems to me we've arrived at a nice point to bring it to an end, to be respectful of energy. It's been really good to talk to you, Dave. I did hope we could do this in person. Now I hear you're around a mystical part of the UK, I'm even more interested, so you'll have to forgive me
I'm back in
if I bother
Australia
you
in
again.
August, so
Okay, August, eh?
yeah, I think so. August,
Okay.
September.
Well, let's
I'm
see.
definitely in New Zealand.
I would love to continue. I big appreciation for your work. Thank you for sharing your time and energy.
Good to talk. Thanks,
All
Tim.
right.